Hello, for the lore of the land, this is Jack Leffler. Today on Encounters with Consciousness, we'll hear from Wes Jackson, founder and president of the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas. Their mission is to develop an agriculture that will save soil from being lost or poisoned while promoting a community of life at once prosperous and enduring. Wes Jackson himself is one of the smartest fellows I've ever met. He knows an enormous amount about ecology and many other subjects, and he applies what he knows to farming, developing methods that fit in with the flow of nature. He's one of very few people whom I've ever met whose consciousness is big enough to recognize that the solar system itself is his own ecosystem. He's a down-home farmer whose grasp of complexity is profound. Listen hard. It's really worth it. Thinking in terms of how people need to understand stuff, I'd like to ask you if you could talk about basically how ecosystems work, and if you need to concentrate on the prairie ecosystem or whatever, but how ecosystems actually fit together and work.
If you'll allow me to ramble a bit.
Go for it.
I like to start with Howard T. Odom's ideas on that. And what he says that in the beginning was the ecosystem. And it was physical. It was everything from wave action and the sunlight falling upon water. You know, he even got into the origin of life and so on. But that the physical world gave rise to the biota, and that what you might call the primal qualities of an ecosystem have to do with sunlight, nutrient cycling, whether it's through wave action, ocean mixing, or whatever. And that when life started out in the ocean, organisms came into the ocean, and that they had to be in conformity to that physical reality. And then when they moved out onto land, adjustments had to be made, but the same fundamental, so that we now have the biogeophysical reality of an ecosystem. And so when Feibelman formulated those 12 laws of integrative levels, going from atoms to molecules to cells to tissues to organs to organisms, within that hierarchy of structure in the formation of those organisms, that is all embedded within the ecosystem, which in turn is embedded within the ecosphere, which in turn is embedded within, you know, the whole solar system, which actually includes, you know, the other planets, in the sense that if we did not have Jupiter within our solar system, there would not be organisms on the planet. You know, this whole thing is just a nestedness from the whole cosmos down to. And so when we think about the ecosystem, And there were others that were asking that as you go up that hierarchy of structure and you come to organisms, what comes next? And some said species, some said populations. And J. Stan Rowe says, what do they all have in common? Says what they have in common at all levels in that hierarchy is contiguous volume. And species don't have contiguous volume. Populations don't have contiguous volume. Ecosystems do. So that is a slab of space-time. And within that, your boundary of consideration. That's the thing about when you look at an ecosystem, the human is sort of setting kind of an artificial boundary. It's pretty easy to have a boundary for the cell. Although you get down to it, it's not quite as easy as you might think. It's sort of easy to have the boundary for a tissue. and an organ and an organism. But then when you start really looking at it, that boundary is far more fuzzy than one might think. So it's fair then at the ecosystem level that we effectively are defining it, and we're defining it for the purpose, from the point of view of the ecologist, to get an idea of what comes across that boundary and what is going out that boundary. And we're looking at the ecosystem's health, overall health. And health is defined largely in terms of some idea of what constitutes stability. There is cycling within ecosystems, but what we know is that when some species go into overshoot, even though there may be some oscillations within that ecosystem, that if for some reason something happens, a predator is removed or whatever, and it goes into overshoot, when it goes down and spikes at the bottom and then comes up, it usually comes in at a lower level than what it was before. So what you have here is a dynamic process of the physical interacting with the biota, and the biota are changing the physical, you know, as through, if there's organic matter that has not yet been mineralized, organisms are doing it, nutrients are being made available, and so on. But what runs ahead of everything else for me is that when you think of essentially all life, whether it's a redwood or a whale or a corn plant or a Holstein or a human or whatever, in our chemistry classrooms, in the upper third of the periodic chart of the elements are 20-some elements that go into all organisms. Four of those are out of the atmospheric commons, and the other 20-some are in the soil. Now, it may be like 95% of the weight of an organism is actually elements that have come from the atmosphere, and a small percentage is actually in the soil. So that tells me that that soil is really this regulatory system for seeing to it that the creatures, you know, well, the creatures are interacting. And so your system, to come back to be a little more precise about what an ecosystem is, it is a biogeophysical assembly powered by the sun, dependent upon the gravitational forces, influenced probably by everything from the solar wind to whatever, and it is a place where there is self-organizing going on that has its ancient roots in an ancient ocean. I mean, it impresses me, and I love the language of old George Wald, the late George Wald, Nobel Prize for his work on the eye. He was at Harvard, and he said that we living things are the late outgrowth of the metabolism of our galaxy. The carbon, which enters so importantly in our bodies, was cooked in the remote past of a dying star. And from it at lower temperatures came nitrogen and oxygen. These are indispensable elements were spewed out into space to mix and form planets and eventually we ourselves. And relevant to the ecosystem, the ancient seas set the pattern of ions in our blood. The ancient atmospheres molded our metabolism. So here we are, products of an evolutionary process at the system level, with the organisms embedded within that system. And one of the big mistakes, I think, in our thinking has been that organisms are alive. And if the definition of life has to do with organism, but if you take that overall more accurate definition of life, organisms are a derivative of a living system. In other words, the ecosphere gave rise to us. We didn't give rise to it. But because we're organisms, then we use words like biosphere, a bad term. It ought to be ecosphere. And by having this bio bias, then we tend to play fast and loose with the physical world. Witness what we've done to the atmosphere, or what we're willing to do to dirt, or what we're willing to do to water. We say, well, that's not living. That's just water, or that's just atmosphere. So we use them for a dumping ground, and so on. So the ecosystem concept, and after Stan Rowe's paper, he came up with the volumetric criterion for thinghood. And after that, my friend Arnold Schultz at Berkeley wrote a paper about the ecosystem as a conceptual tool for the management of our resources. We haven't got there yet, but I think that's exactly where we're going to have to be headed. Well, now, that's a long, unconnected string. But
no, that was great, because that was actually a great definition that you just gave, the whole thing. And I was thinking now, if we got more specific, site-specific, if you could talk about what, after all of your work with prairie ecosystems, if you could kind of give a general overview of what characterizes the prairie ecosystem.
Well, wherever we have prairie, in North America at least, whether it's short grass prairie of the west and northward into the Canadian provinces, or the tall grass prairie, which has gone all the way into Ohio, there's still debate as to whether that is a prairie archipelago or whether it was a peninsula. But at any rate, wherever there's prairie, tall grass, mid grass, short grass, there are what we call four functional groups: warm season grasses, cool season grasses, legumes, and members of the Compositae, the sunflower family. Now, the ratios aren't constant. For instance, in the north, there's a preponderance of cool season grasses. Here, a preponderance of warm season grasses. But those are what have been called functional groups. We don't know how many of those species are there as a result of an ecological imperative, or how many of them are there as a result of mere chance. In other words, may have no perceived functional value, main actual job. We don't know. But what we know is they're there. So that's where we start here at the land. And out on our never-plowed native prairie, our scientists have actually looked at the distribution of warm season, cool season, legume, sunflower family in terms of ratio and number of species and the amount of biomass. And what we find is a lot of warm season and not many cool season, but we have the legumes and we have the Compositae, the sunflower family. So that's where we begin. We say, okay, what was here? And I have learned that during all interglacial periods of the Pleistocene, in this area at least, there were prairies. That's not necessarily the case in places like Iowa, but at least here. So we're saying, okay, that's our standard. That's the template that we're going to work with. That's the analogy that we're going to use. So when we set out to build an agriculture based on perennial polycultures, we want to be mindful of warm season, cool season, legume, sunflower family. And in fact, several years ago, what we did, because people kept asking us questions like, you know, how are you going to plant this out, and how are you going to harvest it, and how are you going to separate the seeds, and so on. So we planted but using annuals, a polyculture, for 2 years in a row of corn, a warm season grass, corn or maize, sorghum, a warm season grass, soybeans, a legume, and sunflowers. What we didn't have in there was the cool season grass. But we had three of the functional groups. Planted them with an air drill. I think it was about 8 acres. And we also planted them in monocultures. And then when it came time to harvest, and because they all either set seed at the same time or they had sufficient shatter resistance that they could wait, we opened up the concave on the combine and lowered the speed, cut the air so it wouldn't blow the sunflower seeds out the back, and we harvested that instant granola. And then we separated the seeds with a seed cleaner. All right, those are mechanical engineering things. We also did a comparison of the yield of the polyculture compared to the aggregate yield of the monocultures on an acreage basis and got a little bit of over-yielding. But, you know, we didn't do any weeding. We didn't do, you know, we just, you know, planted this domestic prairie. But that's only for the purpose of demonstrating, because people were forever asking, how are you going to plant this? How are you going to harvest it? How are you going to separate the seeds? So I'm imagining a future agriculture where we have our perennial Kernza and our perennial other members that are representative of the functional groups as much as possible, and that we just have an annual harvest.
Could you talk about what some of those other members besides Kernza are?
Yes. We're working on sorghum. Stan Cox has been working on a perennial sorghum by crossing the annual sorghum with a wild species, and has perennials and has winter hardiness. And David Van Tassel working on two members of the sunflower family. One is sunflowers. We're making some perennial hybrids, crossing the annual with the perennial, and then some back crosses. And then there's silphium. That is this very drought-resistant plant. Those are oilseed crops. Of course, Kernza is a cool season grass. I would like for us to get started on corn. Corn is going to be very hard, but it's been the primary killer of this continent. It's now the most invasive species that we have. Well, and then with a larger staff, we'd be putting more. You about need one breeder per crop, and then bring in the ecologists. And this brings up, I think, a very important consideration. That as long as we're stuck with the annuals and tearing the ground up every year, you don't have an opportunity for using that broad knowledge about the way ecosystems work to inform agriculture. Because, I mean, here we've had well over 100 years of knowledge being put on the shelf for its own sake to understand how the world is. The utilitarian comes along and wants to know how the world works, is versus works, but how the world is. And even we have the National Science Foundation that started putting money into the long-term ecological research sites. There are 26 of them. The Kanza Prairie here, near here is one. You know, that's since 1980. So is this billions of dollars worth of knowledge just sitting up there, unable to really be applied to agriculture in a meaningful way because we've got the hardware of the annual. But now with the perennials on the horizon, we can begin to now see how ecology can inform agriculture. And instead we're stuck with agronomy, and agronomy is really what we do to mitigate the consequences of disturbance that has to do with weeds, insects, pathogens, and so on. And so I'm looking for the diminishment of agronomy and the rise of ecology informing agriculture. What we call agroecology is really a recent label that we tack on to what the Romans did even. You know, and what was done in the late Bronze Age. You know, there were legumes and so on. But that's, you know, that's not real. I mean, it's, yeah, it's an ecological reality, but it was just, it's still in the category of ordinary agronomy. But now, to be able to bring all that knowledge off the shelf and start applying it with these mixtures, I think, is the big new thing. And it also means bringing more species into the inventory.
Well, apropos of all that, just sitting here thinking, reflecting while you're talking, I was thinking the stuff that sits on the shelf, so much of the science that I have perceived in action, they seem to be focused on one aspect of a given perspective, and they follow that to the nth degree, but somehow it doesn't seem to be perceived as within the bigger system as a starting point. What about that?
Yeah. Well, I wrote a paper several years ago where systems thinking is still reductionism. And I'm not objecting to systems thinking, but one of the things about Feibelman's laws of Feibelman, is that as you move up that hierarchy of structure, at every level, there are emergent properties. In other words, you put two gases together, hydrogen and oxygen, and you get the emergent property of wetness, H2O. You don't get wetness, however, with just one H2O molecule. It takes an aggregation. But nevertheless, that's an emergent property. And at every level, there are emergent properties that by knowing what the parts are only, you can't know what the emergent property is going to be unless you have already seen it. You see?
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of this, of course, has to go back to Aristotle, but the big thing came with Bacon and Descartes. And it came especially with Bacon, saying that, you know, to break a problem down to the point where there's no ambiguity, you know, well, of course, that's when it becomes totally irrelevant. So what we see now in the hierarchy of the sciences is that physicists are the most highly paid, and the least highly paid are the ecologists. There's a pecking order. Priority is given to physics, then the next step up, people that work in molecular biology, and then the next up, cell biology, and then histologists working with tissues, and then, you see, until you have this pecking order within the sciences of you're really getting down to it. Well, in my view, we've got to invert that. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being reductive. The problem is to believe that the world is like the method. It's a method, but the world is not like the method. And that there's an interpenetration between part and whole. Whole influences part, even as part influences whole. I mean, the organisms that arose on this planet gave us this 21% oxygen that we have here. I mean, there is this interaction between the physical and the biological that is a total interpenetration, you know. So a good book on that, where I get most of the language for it, is Dick Levin's and Dick Lewontin's, they're both at Harvard, book on the dialectical biologist. Wendell Berry talked about the necessity to have a conversation with nature. And in a conversation, he said, you have to respect the otherness of the other. And what you get back, you don't necessarily agree with, but it informs the next exchange. Now, the Marxist dialectical approach is thesis, antithesis, new synthesis, synthesis that becomes now the thesis that invites an antithesis, and so on. Well, that is sort of a stiff-legged kind of conversation, you see. So what I think that we need to start featuring is that, yes, a systems approach is necessary, but it is still reductive, and that we need to acknowledge the emergent properties that are sure to come as we begin to have the different parts, you know, making up all these different new wholes. You see, so I'm not against systems thinking, but it is still reductive. And that the dialectical is too stiff-legged for me. The conversation with nature is the more organic Wendell Berry approach.
I don't know. This is my dilemma, is trying to see how to get through this extraordinary cap of economics that has absolutely subjugated everybody's thinking processes. It's, to me, as dire.
Anyway. Well, we've known forever that comfort and security are not the solutions to the human condition.
Exactly.
We've known that. Now, knowing that, why do we keep coming up about the economy? Well, it's because we have a whole bunch of people that don't have the capacity, whether they're rich or poor, they don't have the cultural capacity to assess their situation and live within some means in a tidy sort of way. I mean, of course there's horrible stuff. I mean, and people could accuse me of sitting here and pontificating about all that while I sit on the banks of the Smoky Hill River. But I have to say, there's been times here when, you know, it was the milk cow, the garden, the chickens, and the steer, and the hog, and not much acreage. And it requires, it comes back to David again, and the sling, and the pebbles, that to try to meet Goliath on his terms would have got him killed. You know, he strapped on the armor. He allowed Saul to put that armor on top of him. But he assessed the situation and says, I can't do this. He takes it all off. He takes what he knows, which is his sling. Gets 5 pebbles from the brook and 1 shot to the head and to kill Goliath. Now, as Gans points out, you know, number one, knowing his capacity and knowing to not meet a military insider on his terms and making a commitment before he had a strategy. All of that is what allowed him to reconfigure the battlefield. And that's what we've got to do.
When I visited Wes Jackson at the Land Institute beside the Smoky Hill River near Salina, Kansas, our conversations touched on about every subject imaginable. I have the highest regard for Wes Jackson and his organization, and I strongly recommend that you look up the Land Institute online. This is where the agrarian imagination has staked its claim and is evolving into a sound culture of practice that just might help us thwart our present course to disaster. Encounters with Consciousness is a production of The Lore of the Land and is funded by a grant from the Christensen Fund in San Francisco. This is Jack Loeffler. Thank you for listening.